Welcome, everybody. I mean, this is a wonderful opportunity for us to try and record a conversation between Joseph Milne and Rupert Sheldrake. And I think we can lead straight off, Joseph, if you'd like to frame the question. And I think you and Rupert can talk around that, and then perhaps Rupert can come back, and we'll just see how it develops.
Okay, yes. I suppose the question that, in a way, springs from looking at the Heidegger piece. I don't know if you all had a chance to look at it. But what is so interesting about it is he draws a most marvellous comparison between the Greek way of seeing things and understanding things and inquiring into things and the modern scientific way of doing this. And the differences are phenomenal. In fact, the differences are so great that, in fact, we see that the Greeks actually occupy the world in a different way. That's what's going on. It's not a different theory of things. Now, it seems to me that philosophically and scientifically, this is extremely interesting because it seems to me that we are confronted at the present time with a demand to look at reality differently. You know, obviously, scientifically, which is in your field, but politically, religiously, in every possible way, the same fundamental questions are arising about how we actually apprehend reality at all, in an absolutely fundamental way. Does that question make sense to us? Perhaps I'll qualify that, because some of the things that I've seen in the scientific realm that in a way make claim to get beyond the bounds of modern science, to me, don't get beyond. And I'm sure that's a difficulty that you must have come across. That they're in fact really extensions of the same way of looking at things. You might interpret things differently, but it's still essentially the same thing. And to give an example, one of the things that when I was researching for the last series of lectures on natural law, a thing that struck me enormously, right out of the blue in my researches, was that there are certain things you can only know if your concern is to become virtuous. This is a Stoic idea, that so only the virtuous human being can actually know the things that are meant to be known that make us a human being. And I think that is very interesting. It quite startled me, actually, that that was so, that this raised the whole question of the ethical dimension with modern science, which doesn't seem to have an ethical dimension at all, doesn't know what to do with that. So it kind of hands that over to the politicians or the general public. And that kind of split seems to me to be indicating there's something fundamentally wrong with the approach to reality as such.
Well, there are several issues. One is the style of in which science works, which Heidegger sums up and quite clearly. Then there's the question of how this is leading its science into a kind of dead end, or at least an internal contradiction, and then where it might go next. And first, I think the split's absolutely right. I think in the 17th century, the split was it was where religion and science had to do some kind of deal, and the deal was science gets the whole of nature to understand in terms of objective or would be objective, rational, mathematical thought, and religion gets the realm of spirit or consciousness, as Descartes put it, the spirit, God, and the angels. And this split was built in, and so religion got ethics and subjectivity, science got objective nature, conceived of in this mechanical spirit, where it had, unlike a living organism, no soul, inanimate, unconscious, mechanistic, and the intelligence and purpose of nature was not in nature but outside it, in a kind of transcendent God. So that was the sort of split that was established then. And it's still the underlying spirit of science, and I think why it's changing today is for two reasons. First, the idea of eternal laws of nature crash into the evolutionary theory, which is the other side of modern science. That if you've got a radically evolutionary cosmos and you say that all the laws of nature were there at the moment of the Big Bang, you run into a series of problems or difficulties, which briefly can be summarized as follows. If the laws of nature were all fixed at the Big Bang, and since the universe seems to be constituted in such a way that life can exist and we can exist, whereas there could have been thousands of other conceivable universes where We couldn't, needn't have existed. The standard debate, as you know, is between the universe or multiverse. The universe says that, the universe theory says, the universe is as it is because there was some kind of neo-deistic external mind that intelligently designed the laws and constants of nature and fine-tuned them so they were exactly right, and then pressed the start button and the universe just began, and it's been going on ever since automatically with those intelligently designed laws. Some scientists like that. Others who don't like it say, well, no, actually all these possible universes actually exist, and ours is just one among an infinite number of universes, the multiverse. That's the majority view at the moment. It's the view taken by Martin Rees, for example, president of the Royal Society, master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and astronomer royal. He likes the multiverse theory because it gets rid of God. But now, then the latest twist in this debate, some theologians have weighed in and said, well, if God's an infinite God, he must be the God of an infinite number of universes. Now God's reappeared as the God of the multiverse. But this rather sterile debate is what dominates the scientific cosmological arguments at the moment. But it all follows from the idea the laws are fixed. And this, to me, is a malign relic of Platonism, not understood in its proper sense or in the kinds of ways you understand it, but in a kind of debased, popularized form. The idea the mathematical laws of nature are fixed. It's an assumption. And that's one problem in science that arises from this split. The other problem, of course, is an inability to understand consciousness. Consciousness is nowhere to be seen in a mechanistic universe. It's expelled from it. Yet consciousness studies has now become a major theme within science. Yeah. Scientists have taken on consciousness in the last 20 years, originally thinking that all we need is more brain scans and we'll sort it out in terms of which bits of the brain do what, a kind of neo-phrenology, which brain scans have given a huge amount of detail about brain function. But of course it hasn't led to an understanding of consciousness. And now within consciousness studies there's quite a big debate about the nature of mind. And some materialist philosophers, like Galen Strawson, are now beginning to argue, inevitably, I suppose, that that in materialism implies panpsychism, because otherwise you can't conjure consciousness out of nowhere. If consciousness arises from the matter of the brain, then unless this is some kind of miracle, consciousness has to be latent or potentially present with matter throughout the universe. But this is a new idea that most scientists are quite unfamiliar with and not haven't begun to explore. But these are some of the consequences, you see, that arise from that split. And they're beginning, people could ignore them for a long time, but it's no longer so easy to ignore them.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. One of the things that that strikes me about this is that I don't think the split can, as it were, be glued back together again. Hmm. Because I think, the reason I say that, because I think theology has gone as wrong. Mm. Theologians have accepted the split and come to an agreement. The thing that troubles me is, what is driving the questioning in the first place? What is it that is moving the inevitable role of science? It seems to have sort of been set in motion, perhaps by Newton, and off it goes, almost like clockwork. Not the universe, but the science seems to. The reason I ask this question about what's driving the questioning, what manner of questioning is it that science is doing, is because another major split is between the experts, like you, and all the other scientific experts, and the general public. The discourse is only for those in the know. And one says, well, is there not a kind of knowledge, particularly with the ecological crisis and these sort of questions, the environment, which we all feel connected with in some way, is there not a manner of knowing nature that doesn't require being an expert? In other words, that it belongs to us as human beings, distinguishes us as human beings, to actually have an understanding of nature naturally.
Well, I think it's a very important question, and I think there's a lot of aspects to it. One is that in the ancient world, the knowledge of the heavens and of astronomy was obviously a province of experts, the magi. I mean, it goes back a very long way. The sort of priest astronomer types who knew maths and could predict lunar eclipses and that kind of thing. So there's always been an aspect of science which is like a kind of priesthood, which is expert knowledge and which does impress people. And, you know, when you put a man on the moon or have planes that fly or computers that do wonderful things and stuff, there's clearly an expert knowledge here which ordinary people can't participate in. I see the romantic reaction, you know, at the late 18th, early 19th century as an attempt to recover a sense of living nature for ordinary people. And it seems to me that split in our civilization is the split between the 9-to-5 workaday world where everyone's mechanistic and scientific, and then come Friday evening and the roads of the great cities of the Western world are jammed with traffic as everyone tries to get back to nature in a car. There's people who get rich exploiting the world, get rich because they want a nice little place in the country so they can get away from it all. And so these two coexist in the modern world. And the romantic thing of nature, you know, is very strong. And gardening is one of the most popular hobbies in England. Pets are very important. I wrote a book about pets, and is by far the most popular of my books, because people are really, really interested in their animals, and they understand them in a completely different way from a kind of scientific, mechanistic manner. They understand them through a relationship. So we still have all these things, but they've been privatized. They're part of people's private life. Whereas public life is dominated by this mechanistic, scientific attitude.
So, I accept that, and that's a discourse that is kept private, as it were. It never becomes a public discourse, never has authority. But what is curious amidst all that is that down the local pub, you know, there'll be those discussing the latest theories of new physics or the string theory, this sort of thing. What are they doing? I mean, they don't. They're not going to deal with the question that it's addressing. So I'm saying, what manner of thinking is going on in the public mind that thinks about these matters that it can't possibly deal with? You see, to me, there's a phenomenal alienation there, because they accept it on authority but don't understand it.
I think that raises another related problem, which is that science does have this huge authority in the modern world, but science alone, of all the systems we have, is one which has a kind of monolithic authority. The same science is taught in schools in England, in America, in China, in India. Everybody knows in the realm of religion, if you don't like the Catholics, you can become a Protestant. If you don't like them, you can become a Baptist. And if you don't like them, you can become a Sufi or a Muslim or a Hindu or Tibetan Buddhist or a Theravada Buddhist, and then there's different schools within all those. So within religion there's a pluralism, of religions, and within each religion, including the Roman Church, a pluralism of orders and traditions. Within science there's no pluralism. Science is like the Church before the Reformation, and there's actually no arena for debate within science either. My views are definitely minority views within science. But there isn't an arena within the scientific world for the debate of the bigger questions. The authority depends in the end on funding bodies, and they're dominated by small committees of experts who are the successful scientists, together with representatives of corporations and civil servants. They decide how to spend about $30 billion of our money every year on scientific research, determining the course of research, because most scientists just do what they're paid to do, and they can't do anything unless they can get a grant. So that there's, first of all, there's this sort of central state control. There's no separation of science and state, as Feyerabend pointed out. You know, in every country in the world, there's science and state are united. And that was a prefigured by Francis Bacon, whose vision had the idea of a state-controlled Academy of Sciences, which would be a kind of top-down system. And within science itself, dissident views, if they're sent for peer review for papers like journals like Nature, dissident views aren't going to get a look in. They'll be rejected by anonymous peer review. And they won't appear in the textbooks. They won't be part of the magisterium of science. So science is unique in the sense that it has this global magisterium and extreme monolithic authority. And I think one of the things that could help is a more pluralistic kind of science. If there was an alternative Royal Academy, say the Academy for Integrative Knowledge or the Academy for Regenerative, the Regeneration of Nature or something like that, something with a different focus, which would include alternative medicine, more integrative kinds of science, which could have a different system, a rival or an alternative system of authority and respect. But at the moment we have only one. We have the Royal Society in America, the National Academy of Sciences and so on. So I think the alienation is perpetuated more than it need be by the actual structures that sustain science in this kind of pre-Reformation form.
Granting all of that, where is that commitment coming from? Why is it the government, scientists, I mean, perhaps scientists with a bit of protest, but essentially they've got, if they want the funding, they brought to the line. It seems to me there's an underlying cosmology that's committed to. There's a notion of the universe it's been committed to, that then science, as it were, and all sorts of funny things going on in medicine, unethical things going on in medicine, that sort of follow after. But that thing which is initially committed to is never actually articulated. You see,
I think the myth underlying it is science is a salvation of mankind.
Is that
and
right?
I think it's a secularized form of Christianity. I think, you know, John Gray is very good on this. I don't know if you read his stuff. He's an atheistic philosopher at LSE, political philosophy. But he's very, very against the new atheists. And what he says is, his latest book was Black Mass, and about millenarianism and the decline of the West or something. His view is that a kind of the quest for salvation, the Judeo-Christian myth of history, is that there'll be a kind of salvation at the end of history, either by a saviour or divine intervention, but there'll be a transformation of history through millenarianism, which broke out in the Middle Ages many times. And this was the strand on which Bacon played, and saw, you know, not through divine intervention will nature be transformed, but by man's God-given reason. And the whole enterprise of science was then for human knowledge and power to achieve dominion over the universe, as Bacon put it. So it was knowledge and power. It was a kind of Faustian. I mean, Faust is the myth of science.
Yeah.
And so it was this Faustian urge for knowledge and power, and then that feeds into the whole Enlightenment agenda and progressivism. And Gray makes a very good case that the main Enlightenment political movements are neoliberalism, the idea that the whole world can be transformed through unrestrained science, technology and capitalism. Marxism, the idea that through scientific planning and transformation, and National Socialism, which was also based on a scientific creed, highly technological and scientific in its ideology. All of these are modern ideologies, and one of the latest manifestations is the kind of atheist agenda, Dawkinsian rationalism, the attempt to eradicate science, superstition and religion. That's his aim. And then the whole world would be transformed by science and reason and redeemed through science and reason, because the source of all evil is religion and superstition. So it's a kind of redemptive urge, however perverted. But I think Gray's right that underlying this whole thing is the idea of a redemption of history through science and technology and through essentially knowledge and power. And I think that really is the underlying agenda. And science is paid for by governments, because almost all governments are part of the Enlightenment agenda.
Yeah.
The whole world has been converted to economic development through science and technology, the Enlightenment agenda. It's succeeded where no Christian missionaries or Muslim missionaries ever succeeded. It's converted the whole world. And what's more, the system of science that it's based on is still uniform the whole world over, the same in China, India and everywhere else. So it's been an extraordinarily successful takeover of the world by an ideology with various shades and flavours like Marxism, National Socialism, neoliberalism and now rationalism, atheistic rationalism.
If I could just chair this for a second and just ask you both, because I think, in a sense, Rupert has stated his position beautifully. As I understand it, there is a problem as to what actually caused the split and what was specifically lost out of the ancient world that might, by being recovered, change our worldview. what actually happened to cause this enormous schism, which cut off a whole area of experience and life, which we mourn, I think. There is a sort of either a nostalgia or a mourning or a sense that if only we could recover it in some way, we would modify our worldview. What is it that we need to recover?
Good question. What Rupert said, the history is absolutely spot on. We're in total agreement about that. Mm. But what evades us is what brought it about. And what actually is involved in confronting it, really confronting it. Because I think one of the difficulties is this modern commitment to what you call it, as it were, the mathematical view, as it were, is not seen for what it is. It's a very, very interesting problem. There it is. It works. Everyone's committed to it one way or another. Or, regardless of what school of thought they would think they belong to, they're bought into this. But they don't actually see its nature. Now, the interesting thing is that what I did get, not in this essay so much, but elsewhere, he says, because we don't see its nature, it has a destiny of its own. And his example for that is, in fact, modern technology. Hmm. That we are, in fact, being dragged along by technology. And the reason we're dragged along by it is we think we're masters of it. And because we think we're masters of it, we can't see what it actually is.
So, just to go back, Joseph, you mentioned at one point that science is not addressing the key question.
Culture is not addressing the question.
What is the question you're talking about?
How did this come about in the first place? So we see historically it happened. You can see hints of it even in the late Middle Ages with nominalism, these little moves that questioned universals, for example. You know, it's all sort of tricky little things happened. And you see the shift in thinking about the divine, in a shift from thinking about the divine in terms of being to that of will. And that's a fundamental shift. And it seems that the change in the conception of God was matched by the change in the conception of human nature. So the will becomes the essential quality of human nature. So the will rules the reason. As you, with Bacon, that's very obvious. The reason is, in fact, subject to the will. And the will, of course, is never questioned. Because it's going to be useful.
Hmm.
So there was a shift in the whole of Western culture's commitment to what is true. And yes, we can trace what happened with the church, we can trace all, but how on earth does a commitment to what is true come about? How does a change in commitment to what is true come about?
It's absolutely critical.
Mm. And what's your answer to that?
Well, I don't have an answer, that's why I'm asking.
Could I suggest the answer is in your question? In the question you read out earlier, virtue is required if knowledge is to be received.
Well, I think this is so interesting. Here you get a glimpse.
Now, one of the absolutely fascinating things, and an absolute given in certain schools of psychology, is it is taken as a virtuous act to recover the repressed parts of the personality. That is considered a virtuous act. And it actually leads to a sort of healing. So here you have a statement out of, I don't know, whose was this statement?
This is the Stoics. There's a basic
virtue is required of knowledge to receive. Yes. Exactly what the Sufis say. The Sufis say, yes, knowledge is conferred. And the idea, to me, is absolutely fascinating, that virtue is required if knowledge is to be received. And I would say that ties up precisely with the insights of the best of modern psychology, which is actually what I'm trying to say. But I think virtue, yes, and when you look around us, the one thing that is missing from public life is virtue. And if I could just add on to that, why does Mr. Obama have such a great effect? And I would argue that it is because he actually is virtuous. His family is intact, mm-hmm, his children are well, he obviously loves his wife, he's a good man. And that is recognised almost like it's just people's sensitivities pick it up all over the world. They just know that he's a better man than the predecessor. And so I think there's something absolutely fundamental in this virtue thing.
The thing is that the interesting thing is that putting knowledge and virtue together like that alarms modern thinking completely.
Does it, Joseph?
You see, it really upsets, you know, tell Dawkins, your friend Richard.
Mm. But it's true.
Tell him what he needs is to be virtuous, and then he would change his view. I mean, he'd be terribly alarmed at that. He assumes he's already virtuous.
Yes, no, he assumes he is. I mean, a lot of scientists think they're virtuous because they're devoted to truth. They're yes. not in fact, but I mean, they imagine yes. that science is uniquely devoted to truth, evidence, reason,
you
logic.
See that, do you see that? So, because what is it they're calling this devotion? You see, that is a there's a commitment. Mm. What is that? Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
It's totally interesting, and I'm not saying I can understand it, but I can understand being drawn by the fascination for things, which I think is partly why you're drawn to science. I pick up in your writing that there's a wonder that provokes, as it were. Mm. I can understand that, but when we have a whole 200-300 years of a whole of an entire culture committed to this, committed to a destiny, as you described, you know, committed to a salvation at the end of time, as it were. You think, what actually is that? It's not actually being thought. I mean, it's there, and it's acted upon, but it's not actually in reflection.
No.
Now, that to me is terribly interesting, you see. That they've kind of hidden things of that kind that actually underlies what's going on.
Yes.
Which Richard Dawkins says, he claimed, are just pure reason. Mm. That conceals what he's really doing, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
To say he's just rational, no one else is as rational as he is. This conceals what his own agenda, which he probably doesn't even know.
Well, his agenda, he would claim, is simply the restoration of the Enlightenment agenda.
Yes, well,
he may be right. So what is the Enlightenment agenda? I mean, this is this swept along the entire current of Western civilization. It dominates our educational system. It's the agenda underlying most education and media.
Yes.
The serious media are all dominated by it.
Yes.
It's the agenda into which all educated people are converted or inducted. And so what exactly is it? I mean, it's very widespread and it dominates everything. Yes. And I would say he's just a symptom of that.
Yes, I would agree. Yes.
He's an evangelist for this. Yes. A kind of a revivalist, an Enlightenment revivalist.
But Rupert, what is
yes.
What is the Enlightenment, really? Can you reduce it to something relatively simple?
Well, I mean, its slogans are science and reason and progress, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And progress means moving forwards to something better, and it's actually really this idea of some kind of salvation at the end of history. Mm. That's not itself rational. It's a belief that somehow history will be transformed, and that is a kind of transform of Judeo-Christian eschatology. The idea there's an end, a goal towards which history is moving. So that's part of it. That's the kind of religious component of it. And then the science and reason bit is, the science bit, I mean, the 17th century, many people, I say, think rightly, say that the reason science became so established in the 17th century was the 30 Years' War. All over Europe, Protestants and Catholics were killing each other. Mm. And here were scientists saying, we've risen above that. Here's the third way, which is where, through these wonderful mathematical truths, we can understand the ultimate nature of reality, the mathematical mind of God. It seemed much better than demagoguery and fanaticism, which they saw on every side. So there's a sense in which the internal conflicts of Christianity made a lot of people sick and tired of all that and wanting a third way. And I think that's another big ingredient in it, the idea that it provides something that rises above the conflicts and opinion within religion. And so that's an ingredient in it. And then Newton seemed to many people to embody genuine progress, you know, there was a big issue whether the moderns and the ancients were better and that sort of thing. But along comes Newton, along comes a form of understanding which is not precedented in the classical world, that shows that humanity has gone beyond that and opens up the possibility of just transcending classical learning and going beyond it through the growth of science and reason and mathematics and so forth. And these are all ingredients in the Enlightenment agenda. And then, of course, add in industrialism, technology, and all the things that the gadgets and things that continually amaze us, you know, television, radio, cars, planes, etc., etc., then the entire population is sort of hooked on this and bemused by it, and now the entire population of the whole world, because no society is now untouched by television or the media, and all of them are inevitably impressed by this kind of technology. So it seems to deliver the goods.
Do you think also, Rupert, that when you described the split earlier, you said that science got nature.
Yes.
In a sense, science may well have got nature, but got the outward part of nature. But the split almost is a split between science and nature, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What you've been describing is the history of a growing instrumental relationship with nature.
And the scientific mind is detached from nature, and the scientists imagine themselves observing nature from without. And you know, the seeing the Earth from space was one of the things you see. You know, some people, the American astronauts, said when we look back on the Earth, there was this amazing sense of this Earth floating in space. The Russian astronaut said something much more interesting. He said, when I saw the Earth floating in space, I thought, what's the big deal? It's just like a globe I've seen in the school classroom since I was a child. We already know this. And the wonder is that human minds could journey outside the Earth, see the Earth from outside, long before we had the technology to do it. And there's a sense in which the disembodied mind, the idea that science can range through the whole universe, now back to 15 billion years, the Big Bang, across vast, you know, discovering galaxies beyond our own, ranging to vast, now to multiverses, that the minds of scientists somehow totally detached from human bodies. It is an ultimate split, because science is on the mind side, of course. And that's why I think the icon of modern science is Stephen Hawking, because he's as close as you can get to a disembodied mind.
Right. I totally agree.
Yes.
Terribly, terribly interesting. I do think that complements the banishment to God outside reality.
Yes.
The strange thing is the human mind has put itself where God used to be, as it were,
exactly.
Where God now is also.
Exactly that, yes.
So
it's now beyond space and time, outside the limits of this Earth, of the solar system, of the galaxy.
Yes.
It's sort of looking at our galaxy as one among billions, hundreds of billions of other galaxies, and our universe now is one among hundreds of billions of other universes. Somehow our minds have risen beyond the body, the limitations of the Earth, to encompass the entire universe in vast spans of time, a godlike view.
And of course, this is interesting because this is a fantasy.
Yes,
it is a fantasy. It is very, very. But it comes under the unquestionable name of objectivity.
Yes.
See, and of course, we're back now to Descartes, the idea, you know, of the subjective knowledge and the objective knowledge. So we found part of the commitment. This mind outside everything looking in, as it were. That is the kind of commitment to reality that's at play.
Yes.
You think, well, what is the point of that? What is the point of being outside reality looking in?
Yes.
I mean, what
it's being like God. It's being like a conception of God as an external mind. The mechanistic conception of God is the mechanistic conception of nature is that nature is not an organism. Animals and plants are not organisms with their own governing principles, the soul within them and around them. Instead, there's this detached mind outside nature. This is the mind of God.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, Hawking ends his book, Brief History of Time, says, now we can know the mind of God and stuff. This is, every, you know, new scientist, every few months, there's something on the cover, the mind of God. They keep coming back to this kind of theme.
Yes.
That somehow the minds of human minds have become godlike. So it is, again, a salvational myth that we've become as gods through science.
But epidemics are arising in the body, which is ignored.
Oh, yes.
Because what we've created is a totally disembodied view of man.
Yes.
Actually, the body, which is, of course, the seat of the emotions, has been abandoned. And cancer and not to mention the terror of the afflictions of the body, like swine flu and bird flu and all this, have reached epidemic proportions.
But they have. But you see, your rationalist would make the obvious point the population's never been greater. Not that that's a good thing, but more people survive, you know, modern medicine's extended lifespan, huge transit. All of us are beneficiaries of modern dentistry and surgery and that kind of thing. So if you bring up the body, then that's the response they'll bring
then
in.
It's in much better shape than it was.
Yes, much better shape than it was. Look at people in the Middle Ages with sort of decayed teeth and much smaller and short lives and nasty, brutish and short and so forth.
So what's your response to that then? Because, I mean, it is much better, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think that one would. I think one has to acknowledge that actually modern medicine has made astonishing changes. But the thing is, the lack of wisdom in the whole thing, you see, is becoming apparent because the population set to reach 9 billion by 2050. It's now 6.5 billion or something. So it's becoming increasingly clear that this was all based on short-term things, in prolonging human life, cutting down mortality is a good thing, all based on these short-term goals of naive views of progress. But where it's heading is global climate change and every kind of disaster scenario looming on the limits of our consciousness and sometimes coming into the centre of our consciousness. All these new forms of science-based terror, nuclear war, pandemics, climate change, all sorts of things. And if those aren't enough, then they conjure up ones from world history like asteroid impacts and stuff. So you've got a range of alternative disaster scenarios lurking in the background. But what can you do about them? Well, science can ride to the rescue again, you see. If it's an asteroid impact, we're going to send out rockets with nuclear bombs and nuke them so we can deflect them from hitting the Earth and stuff. And you can see the Hollywood films. They're already, this is the stuff of Hollywood science fiction. Science as the heroes.
Yes.
I mean, these to play on all these mythic themes.
Yes.
I spend a lot of time trying to think, how can we break out of this? How can things be changed? And as a scientist, I think, how can they be changed from within science? And one of the changes is the morphic resonance one, the idea that instead of all the laws being fixed, if there's a memory in nature, there's an interconnectedness of everything through time. They're not laws, they're habits. The regularities of nature grow up within nature. That's one view, because it gives a picture of all nature being interconnected through time. I think consciousness is another one. If we really begin to think about mind, soul, or consciousness beyond the human level, modern science has just assumed that the whole universe, all these galaxies and so on, are inanimate and unconscious and machine-like. But that's nothing but an assumption. And the thought experiment I spend a lot of time on, and actually I'm serious in trying to pursue, is the question of, could the sun be conscious? Could the whole galaxy be conscious? Because as soon as you raise that question, could the sun be conscious, if you look scientifically, what is it that's supposed to link our consciousness to our brains? The answer is, according to modern science, it's complex electromagnetic patterns of activity. That's supposed to be the interface. Well, the sun's got much more complex electromagnetic patterns of activity. So how do we know the sun's not thinking? And all traditional societies have thought of the sun as a god or as embodying some kind of consciousness. Young children, when they're asked to draw the sun, draw it with a smiley face. This goes very deep in our history, our historical consciousness. And if the sun's conscious, then what about the whole galaxy? Could that have a greater mind of which all the different suns are part? The galactic centre is enormously powerful. It's supposed to be a super black hole emitting vast amounts of energy which pulse through hundreds of million mile long magnetic field lines through the galaxy. The whole galaxy has a plasma where electric currents going through the entire galaxy, vast electrical system. If all of that has some kind of mind, and then clusters of galaxies, and then, of course, it's a few simple steps. One doesn't even need to spell it out, because most people get there on their own in 5 minutes. Well, what if the whole universe has a kind of mind? What if there's a consciousness of the entire universe, and we're inside it? And what if the origin of human consciousness, which is a great unsolved scientific mystery, is related to higher forms of consciousness in the universe? Well, this doesn't take us to God. It may take us to the world soul. But then it raises further questions as to where does that come from. But it seems to me that that's one of the lines of thought that I'm pursuing, because I think it's one of the easiest ways for people to realise that we're in something larger than ourselves. Yeah. Instead of the whole of nature being inanimate and mechanical and our minds being the only things that soar through the universe, comprehending it, our minds are part of a much, much... a whole nested, like hierarchies of angels, nested series of intelligence or consciousness at higher levels than our own, and we're within them.
So therefore, isn't that what the ancients propounded anyway?
They certainly understood the universe as intelligent. I mean, there's no question about that. We probably wouldn't have used the word consciousness, but that's the modern... The interesting thing is that they related to it as that. And this is the kind of thing that puzzles me, that what is it to do that? So we can adopt a different explanation of things, but still carry on in the same old way. We can, you know, we can end up incorporating that into an Enlightenment view.
Yes,
you know, and this seems to be so. We actually stay where we are, but with new gadgets added on, as it were.
Yes.
So it still becomes more of the same, and this is why it so struck me, particularly when I was looking at the Stoics. It's very clear that they, if they wanted to know what to do, they consulted the universe. Mm. What is the action that will be in accord with the nature of things? And this is an ethical question. Mm. I mean, Marcus Aurelius, he wondered, I mean, his whole Meditations is really that central idea. Mm. And Cicero's idea of natural law is the same basic position. So that we no longer know what it would be to consult nature in this way. And the interesting thing is, and this is shown in your work, is it seems the animals do. I don't know if you've done research a bit. My grandfather on the Scottish side, he was a horse whisperer. He tamed. He was the village up in Montrose. He tamed the horses when they needed a horse broken in. Mm. He just went and had a word with it, and that was that, as it were. Yeah. And everyone had their little job. My grandmother was the midwife, and she had no nurse training whatsoever.
Yes.
And this, so you had this, and you had all the village life, you had all these, everyone had these functions with the knowledge that they were born with. All that has vanished in the past 100 years or so.
Yeah, here, in many parts of the world, it still exists.
That still exists, that kind of thing.
Now, it exists in an underground form with horses and dogs, even in our society.
Yes.
Mm. It's still there.
Yes.
Would you like to say something about morphic fields in human beings? Because I think that's perhaps the easiest place to see it.
Well, I mean, the starting point for my own thinking is morphogenesis, the development of embryos. This is one of the great unsolved problems in biology, because biology, at the moment, being reductionist, tries to explain everything in terms of molecules, genes, proteins, and so forth. And that doesn't enable you to understand how organisms grow, because there's no formative causation, no formal cause. It's like trying to understand buildings in terms of bricks, cement and timber without the architect's plan. And you can't do it, and that's the base of my wager with Lewis Wolpert. He thinks you can, and I'm convinced it'll never happen. So the idea within biology since the 1920s has been, among some developmental biologists, there are these fields, formative fields, and the key thing here is that in modern science, the word field has taken on many of the meanings that in older science the word soul had. When Aristotle or Aquinas talked about the vegetative soul, it was the formative cause of the body. It was what shaped the developing organism. It attracted the developing organism towards its final form, its mature form. And what he called the animal soul underlay the sensitivity of movements and instincts, and what he called the intellectual soul underlay the mind, words, thought, conscious mind, and so on. Well, what some people called the anima mundi, the soul of the world, held the whole world together. And what people, Thales, starting, that said the magnets have souls, that magnetic phenomena and electrical phenomena were understood in terms of souls. So what happened was they were all abolished in the 17th century. All souls were driven out of science. There were none left, everything was just mechanical, no formative or final causes. And then the first ones to come back were magnetic fields. Faraday, here in London, with electrical and magnetic fields. He called what were called magnetic souls were now magnetic fields. Gilbert, 1600, in his book on De Magnete, about the nature of magnets, said the entire earth is a magnet and the soul of the earth is what makes compasses, lodestones, point towards the north. Well, now Faraday said the whole earth is a magnet and it's the field of the earth. So you have a very clear substitution. Then Einstein's general theory of relativity, the universal gravitational field, is that which includes the entire universe as the basis of all space and time and includes everything within it and provides the very framework of space and time and the interrelationships of all things through gravitation. Then in the 1920s, the idea of morphogenetic fields came into biology, and they're essentially the souls, the vegetative soul. And it was directly influenced by the vitalism of Hans Driesch, who was a leading German embryologist who rejected mechanistic theories of embryology in about the 1880s or 90s, having started as a mechanist, just thought it wouldn't work. And he introduced the concept of entelechy as that which organized living organisms and drew them towards an end or a goal, which is a formative activity. And because entelechy, a totally Aristotelian word, was completely out of fashion in the early 20th century, that's why the idea of morphogenetic fields was introduced. But it took on all the properties Dreschut attributed to entelechy. So in a sense, it's the restoration of the soul to biology in the field, under a field name. So within developmental biology, the idea is that each organism has a field for the whole organism, which shapes it, but also subfields for things like arms and legs and eyes, and then within those fields for the tissues, a hierarchy, a nested hierarchy of organizing fields. And what fields are is patterns in space. And Faraday, in his first conception of fields, said there were two possibilities. One, that fields were what he called modifications of mere space, which is his favoured theory. The second was that they were made of subtle matter, the ether. Well, the 19th century was very materialistic. Maxwell took up the ether theory. And until Einstein's special theory of relativity in 1905, all electromagnetic field phenomena were explained in terms of ether, subtle matter. Einstein abolished the ether. And so they're just explained in terms of fields. And so science is now explained in terms of invisible formative forces called fields, which have a variety of formative influences on nature, including the spherical size of planets, the orbits of planets, the structure of galaxies, and so forth. Electromagnetic invisible fields underlie all modern technologies like radio and television. And so we have all these fields, and within biology, the morphogenetic field concept is where I came in because I started as a developmental biologist. And I think it's the most fruitful way forward. But these fields have to evolve. They're not carried in genes. Genes only carry the code for making proteins, the sequence of amino acids in proteins. So there's another form of heredity, and that's where my idea of morphic resonance came in. The fields are inherited as a kind of memory, based on similarity, a kind of sympathy across space and time between similar things, which is why I was very attracted by that passage in Plotinus about the sympathy within the all soul, where all of nature is an organism, and there's a sympathy between similar things. Resonance is acoustic resonance is based on similarity. So I'm saying that when a young giraffe starts developing as a giraffe embryo, it resonates because it's already similar to previous giraffes. With previous giraffes, comes within the morphogenetic field of the giraffe like an invisible plan or mold which shapes its development. Now humans, of course, have, as Aristotle and Aquinas said, a field that shapes our body as it grows and develops, the morphogenetic field, the form-shaping field, like the vegetative soul. And this also helps to restore the form of the body and the health of the body after damage. It's the basis of healing. And many animals and plants can regenerate much better than we can after radical damage. You can cut a willow tree into hundreds of little bits, and each bit grows, the cutting grows into a new tree. So there's this regenerative capacity, which is very, very deeply embedded in all living organisms, in their bodies. We have that. We also have the emotional system that we share with animals, fight or flight, adrenaline responses, fear-based things, pleasure-based things. A lot of our emotional life, which operates, the bit of the brain it operates through is the lower part of the brain, the limbic system and so on. These we share with many animals. That's, in a way, the animal soul. And then we have the intellectual soul, which is part of these larger, more commonly shared field systems. The field of the body is within and around the body, and just like the field of a magnet is within and around a magnet. And so these fields all depend on memories. So we inherit our form from our ancestors by a kind of resonance. We inherit our animal nature from our human and pre-human ancestors, and we inherit our human nature also, and our cultural inheritance through a kind of resonance. All of these are inherited through a kind of resonance, not through genes. which only account for the proteins we can make in our bodies. And so our heredity includes this biological heredity, mostly from our parents and ancestors, our cultural heredity that we inherit when we learn a language. We do it largely through resonance, so hearing it and resonating with those who speak it. And Chomsky came to the conclusion there must be an innate component in learning language, because young children couldn't possibly learn it as easily otherwise, not by standard psychology. There has to be something innate. And he assumed innate meant genetic. The modern belief, most people equate the word innate or hereditary with genetic. But genetics, I'm arguing, is only a small part of heredity. Most of it's based on this resonance. So our nature is resonant with things that have gone before. As Jung said, well, there's a kind of collective memory on which we all draw. The more similar we are, the greater the resonance. And therefore the people who are most similar to each other, identical twins, would have the greatest resonance, and they have extraordinary similarities even if separated at birth. This is usually taken to mean that their similarities are genetically determined, and therefore there's a huge role of genetic determinism, selfish genes, sociobiology. That whole edifice of speculation is based on identical twin studies. But resonance theory would suggest the similarities are largely resonant. And the similarities between parents and children would be largely resonant. And that's why the crisis has now surfaced, which I draw attention to in my article in New Scientist last week, my wager with Walpert, that the Human Genome Project has been a damp squib. People thought that we'd understand everything about human beings by knowing the genome. And in the year 2000, there was a huge optimism. They thought there'd be at least 100,000 genes. It turns out there's about 25,000. Sea urchins have 27,000, rice plants have 38,000. Chimpanzees' genome is virtually identical to our own, and that you can hardly see any difference at all. So that's the first shock. And the new shock in the last 6 months has been they've now got genomes of tens of thousands of people, and they're now analysing the genomes to explain heredity. And they've taken simple things like height. I mean, everyone knows that parents, tall parents have tall children, short parents have short children. And if you compare parents and children, height is about 80 to 90% heritable. In other words, the height of someone is related to their parents, in very highly correlated. So they then looked at the genes and the genome, and they found about 50 genes that seem to relate to height. That's quite a lot of genes. And then you take all those genes together and see how much of the difference in height you can explain with genes. It turns out to be about 5%. And this is now the crisis in the genome studies. It's called the missing heritability crisis. And I think the reason the heritability is missing, after all these promises they'd soon find it, is because it's just not there in the genes. It's based on resonance, and that genes are grossly overrated. So I think these crises are beginning to erupt within science. And I think that morphic resonance, as a kind of resonance theory, it has a lot of things to say about human nature. And one is the nature of heredity, the influence of the ancestors. It also has a lot to say about the importance of ritual, because in all traditions, all societies have rituals, and rituals are performed in as similar a way as possible. And they're ways of integrating individuals into the social group. And what happens in a ritual, by doing it the same way as before, you know, Passover, American Thanksgiving dinner, whatever the ritual, Holy Communion, by doing it in a similar way as possible to the way it's been done before, there's a resonance with those who've done it before, right back to the first time it's been done. And it not only includes the participants in a group with each other, but with all those who've gone before, and indeed all those who come after, which is what people who participate in rituals actually think. Yet, from a rationalist point of view, it's all mumbo-jumbo. Mm. So I think all of these things actually give us a different view of human nature as linked, organically linked to the ancestors and the past, through tradition, through culture, through ritual, through language, through metaphor and everything else. And the idea of morphic fields you see as nested hierarchies of fields mean that the whole Earth has a field, the whole solar system has a field, the whole galaxy has a field. We're embedded within organisms, or living beings, at successively higher levels of organization. And this is not an arbitrary imposed hierarchy. You know, it's like the fact that Shepherd's Bush is part of London, London's part of England, England's part of the UK. It's that kind of hierarchy. It's a nested hierarchy. They're within the larger systems, the Earth's within the solar system within the galaxy, just as our cells are within our tissues, they're within organs, they're within our organism. And our organisms, as social animals, are within societies. And those too have fields, memories and traditions. Mm. All animal societies, flocks of birds, schools of fish, termites, and as social animals, we're subject to organic organisations of societies that are not just aggregates of individuals, as Hobbesian atomism says. But everybody before Hobbes took for granted that society was a kind of organism, and from this point of view, so it is.
Mm. So you're describing there a situation which we are so disconnected from. The disconnect is catastrophic, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, I don't think we're that... You see, I think most people are intellectually disconnected from it, but I think emotionally they're connected with it.
Yeah. And so it's about recognising...
It's about recognising what we already know. I mean, the reason I'm relatively optimistic is that I think that these things are already there for most people. And they've been... sort of, the relationship to animals and plants has been, as we were saying earlier, pushed into the realm of, sort of hobbies like gardening and pets. But the fact is, these are important parts of people's lives, and in that part of their life, they know there's a connection. And when people get back to nature at weekends and on holidays and that sort of thing, the reason people like hiking in the Lake District and wandering in the woods and having picnics in the countryside and that sort of thing is because they feel a sort of connection with the larger world. Mm. And the reason that rituals persist and get reinvented in the modern world, even though the rationalist attempt to stamp out all organised religion and traditional rituals has been exerted very vigorously, most vigorously of all in Soviet Russia, it hasn't succeeded in eradicating religion because these fulfil a need. And I think where it's becoming increasingly recognised that where these modern atheists, the neo-atheists, have gone wrong is by treating religion as a system of beliefs, a series of ridiculous propositions to which people are forced to believe intellectually, whereas in fact for most people it's a system of practice, something that's actually something you learn by practising. And so I think what's happening is there's a clarification now of the role of religion through this atheist onslaught, that it is more to do with practice and experience than with intellectual belief.
And certainly in the field of psychology, there is some astonishing work beginning to take place, which Rupert knows well, on the constellation of fields for families. So that if you have a systemic problem in a family like alcoholism or whatever it might be, you actually constellate the family field. And by working with it, you can... The Sufis have done it for 1,000 years, I might say. And it really is. I don't know how that ties up with the way the Greeks thought, but it is. You just have to see it to comprehend it. It is simply astonishing. And it does seem that when two or three are gathered together in thy name, something pretty strange happens. And so I think it's seeping in. And maybe if the field is always there, we go through these periods of enormous sort of dislocation, but the field gradually seeps through.
You know, well, I make a couple of remarks that what is interesting about it in reference to the Greek way of thinking is that it is seeing things from the point of view of a greater unity. And that is actually the key to that. That is a fundamental difference in perspective, in how the Greeks grasp reality as such, is their eye was on whatever was a unifying principle of everything first, and as it were, the parts would explain themselves afterwards. Hmm. Now that, it seems that is what's been displaced in this piece with the Newtonian view, where in fact you have the least space now just becomes the empty distance between things. It's no longer place, it's no longer home for anything. This kind of emptying of reality to the least, as it were. So now space is just all these objects moving around pointlessly, as it were, even if you can predict what they're doing. So I think what is interesting is that what you've said about the morphic resonance and these fields does show that the organising principles of nature are not to be found in the minutiae, but in fact the whole in some way. The thing that worries me, and theology is actually my background, and I have to know that you have to do the theologians are even worse than Dawkins, I promise you.
Yes.
A singular thing strikes me about it all, and that is, it remains completely and totally inarticulate. It cannot say itself. So it invents all sorts of borrowed analogies from elsewhere. So you get, you know, the new physics of mysticism, this kind of bizarre thinking.
Mm.
Now, that inarticulacy seems to me to still be the other side of the problem of the supreme articulacy of science.
Mm.
Science simply pronounces, and that's the end of the matter.
Mm.
The religions can't pronounce them, even if they're getting on with it, as it were. And I accept what you say about ritual, etc. And it's always been understood that rites are a ritual remembrance, that it is a repeating of the eternal things, as it were. But if this remains outside the spoken discourse of a culture, there's still something terribly, terribly wrong for it to be underground, as it were.
Yeah.
And that seems to be that the modern situation forces it to be like that. You see, that's the difficulty of it. The Enlightenment put it there, and there it stays.
Because there's no coherent natural theology or natural philosophy.
Yes. So what happens is that if you like, the religious stance, shall we say, the religious stance which belongs to human nature as such, doesn't have a language it can call upon anymore. So it merely borrows from elsewhere, but that means also it can't actually perform itself. So what in fact happens is that it remains, if I put it this way, and you see most modern theology is doing this, it remains within the Enlightenment cosmology.
Yes.
It actually takes that on completely.
Yeah, yes. That's the danger. Absolutely.
So it does, and it is oblivious of the fact that that cosmology, which a lot of Polkinghorne, these are people, you know, he's a physicist that's gone over to the Anglican Church, which is an awful, ridiculous thing to do, from both points of view. But he is trying to reconcile Christianity with the Enlightenment cosmos.
Yes.
Which is absolutely absurd, as if science can now justify religion, as if that solves the problem. And of course, it doesn't, it makes it worse.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it makes it worse, but I can see why he's trying to do it. But I agree with you. I mean, I'm interested in the whole science-religion thing, and I've had many discussions with people, including Polkinghorne, you know, people like that, who are trying to bring that about. The more interesting thinkers that I think of is, Father Bede Griffiths, who was a big, whose ashram I lived in for 2 years, and I knew well.
Right, yes.
He was not like that. He was very much he was drawing an inspiration and a language from both from Western philosophy. I mean, he was very well up on Greek and medieval philosophy, and also Hinduism, and particularly Hinduism, the Upanishads, and so on. And to some
that
extent,
still has that still has a language for a different cosmology.
That still has a language, yes.
Yes.
And I think that theologians like Rowan Williams have, you know, steeped in sort of orthodox theology, which still has some kind of language and sense of this connection. I find him enormously impressive, and his writings I find some of the best among modern theologians. He's not really an Enlightenment. He's not trying to, like Polkinghorne, cellotape together Enlightenment rationalism and Christian theology.
Yes. Oh, well, you know, not denying the goodwill and the good intention. And perhaps in the past decade or so, as a feeling that there is a problem to be addressed, which even 10 years ago there was no awareness of a problem to be addressed.
Right. But I thought one of the most interesting things in your lecture on Providence really fascinated me, you see, because one of the greatest gaps in the whole of modern thinking is teleology, or the sense of being things being drawn towards a goal. Because this was totally ruled out by Enlightenment rationalism. And science is seen as progressive, but the goal is so vague and inarticulate, as you said, that I suppose the goal would be total power, total knowledge, and total domination of nature, and some kind of completion which never happens.
Yes.
But the idea that there could be an actual causal influence working from the future, teleology could be real, both within biology and in the cosmos, and I think in consciousness, is a really interesting point. And, you know, Whitehead thought that one had to take into account some kind of causal influence of the future in consciousness.
Right.
And yes. I'm just in the last year or two coming to the conclusion that actually, if we're going to understand the relation of the mind to the body, it's not that one's inside and the other's outside, a spatial metaphor. It's that the mind inhabits a world of possibility, of things that haven't yet happened, of possibilities of virtual futures. The consciousness, its main role is to choose among them. And in the sense the causal influence of the mind is working from future towards the past. The causal influence of the body and the material world and energy is working from the past towards the future. And what happens in the present is these two causal streams interact. And it's really an interaction of differently moving causal streams. And interestingly, there's quite a lot in science which allows or even suggests the existence of these kind of opposite direct future past influences.
Yes.
And there, you know, this is an area where some of the more forward-thinking scientists actually speculate at the moment. One of the forms it takes is in discussions of quantum theory. Another is in consciousness studies, and another is in parapsychology, because, of course, there's empirical evidence for precognition and that sort of thing. But what nobody has is a clear idea of kind of evolutionary teleology. There have been various prophetic voices, like my friend Terence McKenna, who thought in terms of an eschaton, which was sort of pulling the evolutionary process towards it. Teilhard de Chardin tries to think about that. But there's very little in that way of thinking. And your idea of providence as pulling things towards a unity or restoring a unity was, yes, to me a very, very interesting point and really fascinating.
Lost from Western thought.
Lost from Western thought.
Yes.
It strikes me from what you just described there, that really in a way that the problem is that we get a bit seduced by time. What you've described there is something which...
It's a different understanding
to do with
of time.
Time, in a sense, is it? Future, past, it's there.
Well, it is. Well, it's a difficult question, you see, because the traditional science, physics was traditionally based on the idea that time's immaterial, that the laws of nature never change, the total amount of matter and energy never changes, and nature just goes in cycles. And in a sense, that's a classical kind of view found all over the world. The Judeo-Christian view of time, which is of a developmental process, is a very different one. And that's what gives us the whole drive of Western civilization and the whole, in its secularized form, the cult of progress. And then, first, a vision of biological evolution. I mean, it starts with human progress and the Enlightenment, but biology and nature was static. Then with Darwin, this progressive aspect is extended to all life. And then with Big Bang cosmology in 1966, it's extended to the entire universe. But it started as a purely human progressivist view. Then it extended to all nature. But with that view, there is a radical difference between the past and the future. Whereas the in many ways, the classical view, the more cyclical view, is a more sense of timelessness. Mm. And this is a real difference between Western and Eastern civilizations, because the Hindu view of history, of course, is that you have great cycles, but within a cycle, things start off very well with a golden age, and then they gradually get worse and worse, and we're now in a Kali Yuga, the sort of dark age at the end of history where everything's falling apart. And then the whole universe will be dissolved and recreated, and there'll be a new golden age. So that's, in a sense, a view of history as a downward process towards chaos, the dissolution of families, the confusion of castes, the destruction of harmony between man and nature, or at least the humans and each other and with the world around us. I mean, a pretty good description of what's actually happening. So you can see it that way.
Mm, yeah.
But they've now been educated, all educated Indians, you know, starting with Nehru going to LSE. The educated classes have all been filled with Enlightenment rationalism. They all think the future is sort of computer programming and ever-increasing technology. But all these things are born out of a view of time as having a polarity,
yes,
a real difference.
Yes.
And there's a sense in which this view of time as having a real difference between past and future is a religious view built into our whole Judeo-Christian civilization. And now, projected or recognized, it depends which view you take, in the whole of nature.
One of the things that it needs to be brought in to complicate the providential view is fate as well. which opposes it or is a corruption of it. There's a very interesting work by Proclus on providence and fate, and he discusses how fate works in a completely different plane to their providence.
And what's the difference? What is the difference?
Essentially, the providential, or the destiny of things, the true destiny of things, is kind of the higher intellect belongs to that realm. But if human nature lets itself forget that and be governed by its lower nature, like the biological level, that becomes its fate. So it gets taken over by the biological level, which is not its proper place.
Oh, that's very, very interesting.
The biological is fine left to its own dimension, as it were. If we let ourselves become subject to it, it becomes fate, and therefore destructive. It is an interesting argument.
It is very, a very interesting argument, yes.
Is it possible, Joseph, to consider that, I'm sorry to bring you back to this word, but I think virtue, given that it seems to be so singularly lacking in our almost every aspect of
yes,
our it's national life,
yes.
How would you describe virtue?
Well, it's very interesting. This is one of the more fruitful fields of thought at the present time. There is a growing interest in what's called virtue ethics among scholars, not ordinary people yet, but...
But what is virtue?
Well, virtue is what the Greek and the medieval understanding, what we would call morality, which
yes.
we think of rules and regulations, you shouldn't do this, you should do that, etc., Ten Commandments. Virtue is in fact to do with the qualities of being that you bring to your action.
Absolutely.
So, for example, justice is a virtue.
Yes.
Now, the interesting thing about justice is that it is at once a virtue. If you do a just deed, you do a just act, it means you are just. The just man justices. But of course, but the justice is something in things as well. And this is one of the few things, I mean, of all the things that we can't discuss in our modern times, I have found in teaching, whether they're atheists or New Age mystics, makes no difference. If you raise the question of justice, everyone knows it's important. Everyone knows that you're talking about something that is there. And yet, the thing is, we don't actually any longer have a moral discourse that can deal with it.
Hmm.
The whole modern thinking of morality is rule-based, not virtue-based. If you start discussing the virtues, they do actually start to make sense. I mean, let me give you in 2 seconds a very simple sequence of how they were understood. Because you must have heard of the cardinal virtues.
Yes.
Four cardinal virtues. It's very interesting. They're hierarchical. So you have, first of all, prudence, which is Greek phronesis, which is right apprehension, to see things as they truly are. As a human being, not as an entity outside the universe, but as an engaged human being. So that's phronesis. Then can be followed by courage or fortitude. In other words, to act rightly, you need the courage to do so. Granted you've got the courage, next thing you can do is be just. You have the knowledge and the courage to be just. Given that you can be just, you can be temperate, which is your own inner order. So you actually bring about a correspondence between the order of things outside and the inner order of one's own being, which is temperance. And that's a beautiful traditional understanding that runs right through...
And produces harmony.
Well, the temperance is the harmony. The
temperance, oh, I see.
It begins with a right relationship with the whole of the world outside and culminates with a right relationship inside. In a way, the other way around to how modern thinking might work. Mm. If we think we're going to bring ourselves to order, we start with ourselves, you know, put yourself together, as so to speak. But what is very important about those four is they are actually modes of knowledge. They're modes of being and they're modes of knowledge at the same time. And if you recall the justice one, which is in a way the one that you can begin with, as you recall Plato's Republic, the question is, well, most people get the question wrong. The question is, what is the right way to praise justice?
Praise justice.
Yes. What is the right way to praise justice? Not what is justice, which the modern scholars say. So you start straight away. You can only know justice if you're prepared to praise it. See.
What does that mean, in fact?
What does that mean?
Yes. What, maybe to, praising justice.
Well, you mean to affirm to put it before oneself, to make it that to which you grant the whole of existence.
To praise it in the sense of, well, that's one thing, but or when you come across it, you mean to recognise it, or?
Well, you should praise it through simply contemplating it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's how Socrates approaches it in Republic, because they build this analogy, you know, of the state, as it were. It's only an analogy; it's not to be taken literally. So that they inquire into what his nature is, but the point of inquiring into its nature was so that you praise it correctly. See, the very, if I may just cut a couple of that, right praise, is that we think the modern thing, what on earth could that be, right praise? Is there such a thing as wrong praise? Well, there is. And in the Laws, Plato's dialogue called The Laws, which nobody reads, he comes out with this extraordinary, he says, now the most important thing that society must do is have hymns to each of the gods. This way you start, as it were. And the most important thing about these hymns is they must have correct or true appellations of the gods. Because if you misdescribe the gods, you'll invoke a curse instead of a blessing. So this thing, this praising the gods is dangerous right from the very beginning. Now, what I think is interesting about that is we would not, in our time, think that was dangerous.
Hmm.
We think we could say any old thing, we could give any old description of the gods or God, and it wouldn't really matter. But to the ancient mind, it is full of consequence. And what I find interesting about it is that position of situating yourselves before anything else, before the gods, as it were, this is a comportment to reality. This is why I'm so interested in this question of what is it we're doing when we're inquiring into things? What kind of comportment of our being is taking place?
Hmm.
Is it, we sing clearly, it is to dominate. That's the Enlightenment view. It's to dominate, to rule over reality. With the Greek mind, it was to submit to it.
Hmm.
To let the mind be conformed to it. And that's what Aquinas describes, you know, that knowledge is the conformation of the mind to the forms of things. So you're informed, literally receiving the forms.
Hmm.
I mean, that would work very interestingly with the fields that you've been speaking at.
It would, yes, yes.
So there's actually a receptivity of the actual substance of things themselves. It is the things that are received in the mind. What Aquinas says, and you'll find it right through from the pre-Socratics, is the truth of things is the things. It is not explanations or theories or descriptions or axioms. Going back to this article. The truth of things is the things themselves. Now, you see, it's very, very interesting that kind of knowledge is the first thing that went with Descartes.
Hmm.
Right? So all you have is a cogito. The things themselves are now incommunicable.
Hmm.
You can't communicate with them, and they can't communicate with you. So you have the whole objective world outside that you somehow need something to sort of grasp it with. So you have kind of geometry, a kind of grid to impose upon it, as it were,
hmm.
but which never actually a communion with it in any way.
Yeah.
And this is what I think is so interesting, is that this ancient understanding of this ancient epistemology is in fact communion with reality. And on that basis, you suddenly see that from that level, that what is known can come out as poetry, philosophy, or science. What can be articulated from that communion with things can manifest in any of these three discourses.
It's so interesting, because Rilke has that lovely thing when he says, perhaps our real task here is to name things.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Bah.
Yes,
that's only it. Then he goes on, yes. He says tree, house, and so on.
That's it.
So that absolute, which actually a lot of the Indians said.
Well, is this part of Goethe's critique of Newton?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes,
he very much emphasised the quality.
Yes, he does.
And what it seems to me that you're describing there when you talk about the gods is really the quality.
It's a way of putting it. I just regard the gods as gods.
Whole idea, isn't it?
I don't like to translate the gods into something else. Or I don't like to see them as metaphors.
Yeah.
I don't think I know enough to decide that they're metaphors.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
They have to be regarded as gods for there to be the right attitude towards them. If you translate them into something else, the attitude shifts.
Very interesting. So justice, in that sense, is a god.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, I mean, justice is absolute. And the interesting thing is that at the end of the Republic, after that great long discourse of what is the right way to praise justice, the only person that can praise it is the just man. And he's also the only one that can know it. It can't be known otherwise. You have to be it to be just, to know justice. And that's where the idea of the philosopher king comes from. But that's, he doesn't really mean that we should do that.
But this communion with reality, like Goethe, I mean, I've always been interested in Goethe, and actually it so happens I'm rereading The Metamorphoses of Plants at the present.
Oh, right, yes.
I was asked to review a new edition. And when I was an undergraduate, I read a wonderful essay about Goethe and the idea of scientific truth by Erich Heller. And it was this idea that Goethe was standing against the whole Newtonian tradition, which detaches you from what you're seeing and tries to bring back a kind of intuitive understanding. So you look at plants and you actually see the way the plant is constituted and how the different parts are related. It's not a theory, you see it in front of you. And this is something I spend a lot of time doing. I walk most days on Hampstead Heath and I spend a lot of time looking at plants. And I usually carry in my pocket a hand lens so I can actually see the smaller scale structures of the plants. And one of the things I like doing is looking through the lens into a foxglove or something. You get a kind of bee's eye view of what it's like to enter into a flower. And this method of actually looking at things and being directly connected is what Goethe, I think, was emphasizing. And as a way of directly relating to what you're looking at, animals, plants, bones, or whatever it is you're studying. And his thing of colours, too, was very related to this. You know, he was against Newton's theory of colours that saw them as mere prismatic reflections.
Right.
His whole thing was, nowadays I suppose most people would dismiss it as a merely subjective theory of colour, but it was to do with the way that when you have shadows against a particular background, they look a different colour from if you see, it's now acknowledged as part of the physiology of vision, but that sort of translates into a kind of subjective view of colour. So that doesn't overcome the split between the objective wavelengths and the subjective qualities. But the looking at plants does, because it's more clear you're actually looking at the phenomenon.
Yes.
And as he talked about, looking for the ur-phenomen.
You see, that gets recast into the subject-object duality. And this is a tremendously interesting problem, because that mode of knowing doesn't work with that.
Yeah.
But if it gets redescribed in that way, and dismissed in that way, as it were, which is what it amounts to, we're still where we are. And that these are the kind of areas where I think that the inarticulacy is so important, you see. If the metaphysics can't be re-said, then the discovery doesn't yet count. Do you follow my way of thinking when I say that?
Yes.
That the whole epistemology has got to be reformulated, not merely the discovery itself. That seems to be the great difficulty. And this question of virtue actually is a different epistemology.